the Wildlife Observer Network.
Welcome to, I guess this is Nature's Hype Man, would be of all the various podcasts we have. Sometimes it's hard to figure out which one exactly we're doing, but I think Nature's Hype Man fits this one the best. And is it Barons?
Yeah, Barons.
Is that? Yeah, Ken Barons. I became Facebook friends with this guy, I don't know, at least a year ago, maybe two, and I'm really, you know, you are a guide for tropical birding.
That's right.
And you travel extensively around the world. You live in Madagascar, although you're from the States, and I've seen your post. I'm like, this would be a great person to get to talk to. I'd love to know more about Madagascar. You've been to Guinea a lot. This is two islands. Really fascinating to me. I thought it'd be cool to talk to you about that. But in the interim, I don't, you know, of us trying to get together to do this, I didn't know if I didn't know about it yet, or have to, or it just you started it in the interim. You started your own podcast, and it's called Naturally Adventurous, and it is absolutely one of my favorite podcasts. And there's no hyperbole there. I listen to every episode. I really enjoy it. It's you and your fellow guide, Charlie. What's his last name?
Hesse, I guess. Or Hess.
Charlie Hesse.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess they call him Charlie because he's
Charlie.
British.
Yes.
And you guys just talk about your travels, and you also have the thing where you do your top 10 birds, your top 10 mammals, and I really liked that. And you talk about your experiences living in different countries. You live in Thailand. You live in Madagascar. You also both, I think, have lived in South Africa.
That's right. Yep.
So, if the content that I was going to ask you about, people should just go to if you like our podcast, subscribe immediately to Naturally Adventurous. You will absolutely love it. If you love wildlife content, this is a fantastic podcast. And I'm honestly, it's, you know, my favorite of wildlife podcasts that, you know, that I listen to. I mean, I do listen to our own podcast, but it's different.
It's a little different. Thanks.
So,
thanks, Tony. Thanks for the ringing endorsement. We appreciate it. And I like what you do too. And you've got you wear different hats, and I like your different hats. Like, you take things from different angles. So it's cool. I like the sort of the social commentary angle that you often engage with.
Yeah. I mean, it's, so, you know, essentially it's mostly Taiki and I, that we have a lot of other collaborators in Taiki. You know, obviously he faces a lot of these problems because he can't not being a, you know, a 20-something, you know, black man in America. So, you know, obviously, like, we're going to talk about that. He's also, like, I'm a little bit younger than me.
Right.
More like, I'm a punk rocker, but I'm more like class warfare, and he's more like identity politics. So, like, it's definitely like, you know, that's that definitely colors our perspective. I think it's a good combo.
Yeah, it's a good mix. Definitely.
Yeah, but you talk about, you know, like, you don't ignore things either. Like, you know, there's, you know, poverty and issues where you are, and where you take the tourists to, and it's something you talk about. You know, you don't ignore it. But yeah, we have a. I have a heart out in 50 minutes, so I think we should get crack-a-lack. And I guess I'll have you go first, since people get to hear my voice all the time
sure.
on our cast. So, you love doing these top 10 lists, top 10
yeah, that was
mammals,
how we started, yep.
Nature experiences. And I think they're great. We don't have enough time. Some of these take multi episodes to get through your list, so and we're trying to do both of ours in one, so we'll see how that goes. So I definitely want you to go first. I can just read my list off quickly at the end, but so the idea is five easy places to see difficult animals. Now, the two examples that these are ones I haven't seen, but I know exist. One is the monastery in Minas Gerais, Brazil, where they feed maned wolves, which is normally a really, really hard animal to see. Although I actually happened upon one in the Pantanal.
Ooh, nice.
The lodge didn't believe us. They're like, yeah, we just saw a maned wolf this morning. And they're like, well, we haven't even seen tracks in 5 years. No one's seen one in 10. And I was like, I was like, well, look, like, what it looked like. And I was like, I was there with the college group, but even though I was like 10 years older than everybody, and they're like, well, what it looked like? I was like, well, it looked like a red fox on stilts. And they're like, well, that sounds right. And then I was like, well, how about this picture I took of it? You know?
That probably settled the issue, yeah.
Yeah, and then, like, literally, unfortunately, I ran back to my cabin to wake up my roommate, and the people I was with, they actually filmed Rhea's chasing it off.
Oh, wow.
So
that's got to be, like, the most epic Pantanal sighting ever.
Yeah, that was... so there's that. And then the other one I thought about was... You mentioned in your you've dipped on it. Well, Charlie's dipped on it, I guess. But there's a restaurant in Thailand where Sun Bear comes to the dumpster.
Right.
And I was like, well, these are two. And so it got me thinking about often when you travel a lot, and you travel way more than I do, you come across places where it's normally really difficult species to see, but there's one place you know you can see it pretty easily. And I always thought that was a pretty cool phenomenon. I thought no better, you kind of personally put it in my head, but I thought no better person to talk to than you about that. So I'll let you start with your list.
All right. I like the concept. I had to think hard about it, but I think I came up with a few good ones, and I'm eager to hear yours as well. So you want to alternate, or how do you want to do it?
Yeah, let's alternate. That sounds like one. Yeah, let's alternate.
All right, so my first one is a Malaysian night heron. So this is this like very weird kind of brown, intricately patterned night heron. It sort of looks like a bittern, and it's found all over the sort of tropical parts of Asia, and it's just an unbelievably difficult bird. It's like some of these like forest bittern in New Guinea, and like some of these, you know, real forest dwelling herons. Just super, super shy and elusive. Almost everywhere, except Taiwan. And so for some reason in Taiwan, it's just adapted and it's become this like urban bird. It's become largely diurnal, and it wanders around in like the city parks in every like city and town in Taiwan. And like you can almost walk up to them and like shoo them away. And the famous place, I think, is the Taipei Botanical Gardens. But you can see it in, like, any town in Taiwan. And it's so weird. You know, and it's just fascinating to me, like, how did they change? Like, something changed about, you know, maybe there was some kind of niche that was left unoccupied in Taiwan. I don't know. Or just maybe it's just a behavioral change. But it's, like, one of the more conspicuous birds in Taiwan.
It's funny. That's what I'm on my list.
Oh, is it?
So Rambo, my band, which is why people haven't probably heard me as much lately, because we're recording our album now. But I also had to, write all the lyrics and everything. So and practice. So I haven't been able to do as many casts with that. But yeah, so Rambo has, we played, we toured Asia, including Taiwan, and I've read something about those birds beforehand and went there and saw them all at the Taipei Botanical Gardens, and we actually even have footage of it. We were going to make a birding documentary about our tour, but we have some of the footage, including of that bird. In fact, I did a presentation on it for the DVOC about my Asia trip and actually have a photo of it. But yeah, that's funny.
We
wouldn't have any overlap.
I know,
but I have some. I have some honorable mentions that I'll bump up instead.
All right. So my second one is this is kind of cheating. You know, Charlie and I do this sometimes in our top 10 lists.
Oh wait, are we alternating, or are you just doing your five?
Oh, so that wasn't your. You're gonna bump that for an honorable mention then.
Oh, you go. Then you can do two. Then if we have time, I'll just mention it. All right. That sounds like the plan.
So this is cheating, but this is going to be a combination. So you know, I live in Madagascar, as you mentioned, and most birds in Madagascar aren't too hard, but there are a few really rare birds that are like almost impossible to see, and especially if you're talking 20 years ago, which was when people were just starting to come to Madagascar in numbers for birding. These are just things you weren't going to see. You know, they're in the field guide. They're going to kind of torture you, and you're not going to see them. So specifically, this is Madagascar serpent eagle, red owl, which is a beautiful like red taito in the same genus as barn owl, and Slenderbilled Flufftail, which is this weird little rail. And bizarrely, and then there's another bird called Madagascar Pochard, which was believed extinct. And then about 15 years ago, I think it was the Peregrine Fund, or maybe in association with Durrell, they found this little population of Madagascar poachers just happily living on a lake in this remote place in the highlands of Madagascar. And in the same place, they also found serpent eagle, red owl, and slender-billed flufftail. And so it's this amazing place called Baminevka where you can go up and see all these birds like with ease. So it's like four birds went from being like near mythical, never seen by anybody, to like you can easily see them in 3 days in one place. It's just like too good to be true.
I mean, is that just the one? Is that like the one ring? Like the one place to
Exactly.
rule them all? Because, what a threefer,
Shangri-La.
and then some. Yeah. So, should I go now?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. So, yeah, it's funny. The second one on my list was going to be the Taipei Botanic Gardens with the Malayan Night Heron, but number one on my list was the jaguars at Porto Joffre in the Pantanal. So people study jaguars and never see them. Like pe there's people whose entire careers have of studying jaguars have never seen one, right? They've seen their tracks, they've seen their dung.
Scratch
They
marks,
collected
yep.
stamp, yeah, but they've never seen them. I know that's way for panda and a lot of other. So they're unbelievably elusive, and but I don't know, about a decade or so ago, they figured out. I guess these fishermen. Porto Joffre is this fishing village, like a resort. Like don't like think like like shacks on stilts or something. Like it's like a resort where Brazilians go to go fishing on the Cuiabá River. And they found that the jaguars come to the river to feed on caimans and capybara, and also I think just to cool. And it's the densest jaguar population in the world. They're also the largest in the world.
Oh, so the jaguars there are bigger than any other population. Is that right?
That's what I understand.
Oh,
Yeah.
wow.
So yeah, and it's interesting. It's very much like an African safari. If you've ever been on one, not you, our listeners, where they even though they're all different safari companies, although I think the guides often just like rotate between the companies. But when you're there, they'll just be on the radio and they'll be like, "Are you Simba?" And like they all have nicknames for each other. They don't actually. So when he asked later, we're like, "Oh, what was that name?" The word kept saying, "Oh, that's Jeff." Like. What? Like, I think that's our nickname for him. But they all like call out, they all have nicknames for, they all call out what they're seeing, and everybody, there's a lion, there's a leopard, and everybody, congregates. Same thing with these boats go out, and if someone sees a jaguar, they call on the radio, and everybody comes up. And I think it's a really good way to see them without really disturbing them because they're just doing their thing. And yeah, so I went, I let it, I only time I got to. A little tour. Unfortunately, the guy who owned the tour company, he got sick and eventually died. Terry Colburn from Northern California, wonderful, wonderful man. And so I got to lead one tour for him, and it was to Brazil because I had done spent 3 months there before and went with Paula Bucci from Bucci Expeditions. But we got to see the jaguar there, and it was phenomenal. And on the way, you get to see like giant otters, so.
Oof. I tell you, I want to see giant otter almost as much as I do jaguar, but I've seen neither.
Yeah, they're a lot easier. But I mean, if you go to, it's one of the things, if you go to the Pantanal, and before it was like you would spotlight at night and you had like a, probably like a 25% chance of seeing a jaguar. But this is, if you go on these boat trips, it's almost guaranteed, especially if you go on more than one.
Yeah, amazing. I'll briefly tell you something funny about African safaris. So yeah, there is this like radio network, as you describe, like all these different sort of driver guides running around, and then they find an animal, and then they're signaling to their buddies on the radio. But so they used to use the Swahili terms for these animals. So like lion is Simba, But after the movie The Lion King came out, you know, a lot of the animals in there were called by their Swahili names, and then so like Western tourists figured out the code, and so they had to like change the code, and so now that you know they have different names for like leopard, I think they call it like the Swahili word for spotty rather than the Swahili word for leopard and that sort of thing. It's like to calibrate the code. So do
Nice.
you want to give an honorable mention to catch up, and then I'll go into my third.
So my honorable mention was polar bears at Churchill, Manitoba.
Ooh,
And this, what the reason why it's kind of like honorable mention is polar bears aren't hard to see if you go where they are. You know what I mean? Like that's the thing about polar bears is like. It's tundra, right? Like you could see for, you know, dozens and dozens of miles, and you know, if there's a polar bear there, you'll see. It's not like they're hiding in
Right.
dense rainforest.
They're 9 feet
Like,
tall.
yeah, it's just that it's very like economically. I mean, it's $10,000 to go. I got to see them at Churchill, and not even actually my. I mean, I saw them on Cape Churchill, not actually the town. But I did I worked in snow I did a snow I worked as a field tech in a snow goose camp where you're from what I heard and it was actually confirmed by I actually interviewed the PI a few months back for the podcast that I worked for. This is over 10 years ago, like 15 years ago, but he said that a polar bear researcher was like, "You guys are insane." Like polar bear researchers like flying helicopters and like dart them or like we actually camp in like the densest polar bear population in the world, and so once they come ashore, you see them every day. They try to get in the camp, and you have to like scare them off with like cracker shells and everything. So, I didn't go on one of the tours. Obviously, I was just on the ground with them. But yeah. So that's why I put us honorable mention because it's like you know they're normally you know if you can get to where they are, they're easy to see.
Yep.
In fact, you can go to Churchill like in like August and just like drive around and you'll see one. Like you don't have to, you know, it's just really the best time to see them is because the Churchill River is so large, it lowers the salinity in the Hudson Bay at the mouth and the ice forms first there, so the bears congregate in the town. But if you just get to like, you know, I think if you get to Barrow, if you get to Churchill, if you get to Spitsbergen, like you're gonna see a polar bear. You just have
Right.
to invest the time and money, you know. So.
It's crazy how far south that high Arctic environment penetrates down along
Yeah.
Hudson Bay. It's just like, what, almost 1,000 miles south of its sort of normal distribution.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, it really it's and it also that's also why Minnesota is so cold, right? It brings that
Right.
like cold water and down.
Middle of the
So
continent, right?
yeah. You're actually like farther south than Stockholm. In fact, when I was in Alaska, I was farther north, but there were still trees. You know,
Yeah,
it's interesting.
because it's coastal.
Yeah. All right, so I'll just say quickly to catch up, my other one was the Cassowary House, the Southern Cassowary in Corunda, right outside of Cairns, aka Cairns, Australia. And
Hands.
Southern Cassowary is a very difficult bird to see, although I think another spot for them is just like Eddie Bay. There's like a beach where they'll like come up and eat your chips sometimes.
Yep.
But it's a bird that like we're gonna go further north to Iron Range and there's cassowaries there, but no one ever sees them. So I was like, well, I really want to see a cassowary. And they're like, why don't you go to Cassowary House? Just come a day early. So I went and stayed at the Cassowary House, and like I was expected to see one like maybe like in the morning, like walk across a path. And there, I get in, I put my bag down, and I just hear cassowary, and I look out, and there's a cassowary like at the bottom of my stairs. And like you just like come back from birding, and like, you know, and then like there's a cassowary looking you straight in the eye, like, and you have to back up. So it's like really, really interesting.
Awesome.
But it was awesome. But we did get to see a pretty cool sighting. I know there's other places that are probably fitness list where you can see tree kangaroos pretty easily. But we happened to see a tree kangaroo, was it Bennett's tree kangaroo, just in the forest. So there, rather than like one of the spots where they're more easy to see. So that was, we got to see a legitimate hard to see sighting as well as part of that. All right, so I guess you're up next.
Alrighty, I'm going to throw in a very quick honorable mention as well, since you remind me of it. In Australia, you know, there's this one site where you can see Plains Wanderer, which is a monotypic family, and I guess it's basically on a private farm or ranch, and the guy who runs it essentially has a monopoly on this like whole family of birds. If you want to see it, that's the place to see it. It's all sort of all over Australia, but just very elusive, and he's just like got it down to an art to find this thing for visiting birders. I don't remember. I haven't seen it, and I don't remember all the details of who it is. I'm sure some people, some listeners, will know that. But I always thought that would be pretty cool to like essentially have a monopoly on a monotypic family.
Yeah, I know some friends have done that. So I, on my list, this is when I go back to Australia, I'm gonna go with the family, and like, you know, it's hard not to just like see Sydney and then go to Cairns.
You know, like, yep.
But I'll try to visit, you know, Ed down in, who started Bird the Faggot Home down in Melbourne, and then go from there, because I think it's in Victoria. That's the spot.
Cool. So my number three, let's see. So this is also sort of a multiple. It's another, you know, I'm cheating again, but this, like, I realized when I was thinking about places where it's, like, locally incredibly easy to see very, very difficult birds. I realized a lot of these really come down to local knowledge and good local guides who just who stake things out and monitor things and pay attention. And to me, the most amazing place I've seen like this is Lake Baringo, which is in the Rift Valley in central Kenya. Sort of dry, semi-arid, or almost semi-desert kind of thorny brush country. And there is a culture there of local guides who have just become incredibly skilled at finding nocturnal birds at night. So you can show up at Lake Baringo and connect with one of these local guides. And within about an hour, you see five species of nocturnal birds during the day. So you see spotted eagle owl. It's actually right at the like hybrid zone where spotted and grayish eagle owls meet. I've seen hybrids. You see white-faced scops owl, African scops owl, three-banded courser. One or two, or sometimes even three species of nightjars. That place just always blows my mind because it makes you realize, like, the potential to stake out nocturnal birds. Like, you could probably do that anywhere if there were people who are dedicated enough to it and knowledgeable enough. It's just that it hasn't happened many places, but it's always a treat to go there.
That's awesome.
Highly recommended.
I need to, yeah. And I just, our honeymoon was to Kenya. We just did like we just found a good price on a general safari. Although it made a life, it was great. No complaints. It wasn't that bird specific, but you know, I did my best. I befriended the guy, Dominic, who'd actually been on the podcast before. So that, and that was great, but I got to go back. It barely wet my whistle.
Do some serious birding.
And it's just, I mean, Africa's just unbelievable. I mean,
especially East Africa. It's such a complex patchwork of habitats, and then all the big mammals. There's no place really quite like it. I love it. And it's incredibly dynamic too, because you just have like moist and wet habitats close together, things moving around through the year, and as rains fall, it's never boring.
Oh, awesome. I guess I'm next then, right?
Yep.
All right, so I'm rearranging my list just because that's a great segue. Your list reminded me of the ant pit is at Angel Paz in Ecuador.
Yeah, good one.
So,
yeah.
And I know that this is now a phenomenon throughout Ecuador. And in fact, I understand that they've taught guides from Asia to do this with pittas, right?
Which, yep.
This guy, just lovely man, just figured out that somehow to be patient and to mimic their calls and whistles and have a steady supply of worms, he was able to feed ant pittas and some tapaculos and some other species and some of the, like, what's the button quail stuck in my head? What's the
wood quail, little, right?
Some wood quail.
Toucan barbit as well.
Yeah, it's just this, I mean, I got to see was it, 5 species of ant pit in a day, and I've only heard the ant pit as before, you know, like all my trips to South America before. And so it's just a great trip, and the food is phenomenal, and the people are great, and you know, you start your day at an Andean Cock of the Rock lek, and then, you know, 20 minutes later you're looking at a giant ant pitta, and then you just go from there. So I know that that's kind of more widespread practice now, but he was the OG for that one, and
definitely
it's just a really cool phenomenon, and it's really great because, you know, it's great to support all these, but you know for a fact that you're giving money to this family directly who's, you know, preserving this land, and then it's a really incredible experience. Did I mention how good the food was? I love Ecuadorian cuisine. Oh my God.
But you like those soups? Ecuadorian soups are
amazing.
Yeah,
see, I'm like I like cold weather, you know, and I like hearty food. And I mean, I like all kinds of food. Don't get me wrong. I love Thai food. I love Indonesian food. But, like, there's something about, like, food, like, Latin American food that's, because it could get kind of cold up in those mountains, you know, that's a little bit more hearty. Oh, such a great combo.
I'm with you. You're making me hungry right now.
Yeah.
Nice caldo.
Mm. All right, buddy.
Cool. Let's see, the fourth one on my list. I really didn't rank these in any way, and there's so many more I could have thought of, but yeah, this is actually an American one. At first I didn't have any American ones in there, but I thought this was worthy. So black-backed woodpecker. I don't know what you think, Tony, but I would say this is one of the more tougher birds to find, like in the lower 48 states. It's like just super low density. You know, you get it up in like northern New Hampshire and parts of the northwestern United States, but it's just very, very low density, kind of quiet, inconspicuous bird. But sort of 15 years ago or so, there was a huge fire in the Black Hills of South Dakota, and it just killed tons of forest. And I guess this made conditions perfect for black-backed woodpeckers. And the Black Hills just got absolutely flooded with black-backed woodpeckers. And so I was there for 3-4 years after that burn. And black-backed woodpecker was just like one of the most common birds in the Black Hills. You just heard them everywhere. I mean, I was doing bird surveys. I was doing point count transects. And I mean, you could get 10, 15 in a morning easily. It was just this absurd abundance of something that is generally such a hard bird, especially in the lower 48. And I haven't heard what has happened to them. You know, I'm sure the forest is regenerating and conditions are not so good for them anymore. So it makes me wonder where all those black-backed woodpeckers went.
Yeah. I understand that that bird is very difficult for most people. So I happened to... I saw it in Churchill, I saw it in Algonquin, and I did this weird, like, hippie bus camping thing in California called the Green Tortoise, where it's like a hostel on a bus, and I just did this trip into the Sierras and happened to see one.
Really?
So, like, I've had, like, really good luck with that bird, but I understand that it's, like, a nemesis bird, you know? It's like spruce grouse.
Yep.
To me. Where,
You know, it's a little bit like spruce grouse in that when you actually stumble on one, it usually just sits there like 10 feet away and pecks at the tree, or like, it's not shy, but it's just inconspicuous and just really low density.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, I know that bird is I know a lot of people who have seen spruce grouse and rub it in my face have not seen black-backed woodpecker. So now, and my luck with black-backed woodpecker is hard. I mean, with spruce grouse, I mean... You know, I mean, granted, I was in a tundra at Churchill, but still, we walked around the woods and didn't see it. And did field work in a season in Alaska. The guy I worked with had a golden yellow lab and was like, "Oh, you want to see a spruce hen? We'll just go into we'll take her into the woods and she'll find one, no problem." Didn't find it. A birder offered to take me on Burning Pal when I got back to Fairbanks, and he's like, "Oh, this road's full of spruce hens." And then, of course, there was a fire, so the road was closed. I get back to the cabin I was staying at. This local artist up there, I think Judy Gum is her name. She let me stay in her guest cabin in Esther, Alaska, right by Fairbanks. And a female and, like, 11 chicks walk through the yard and she showed me the picture on her phone. So, true nemesis. I guess I'm up next. Yep. So, all right. Harpy Eagle at Serra das Arales in Mato Grosso. So, this is, you have to time it when they're nesting, but luckily it takes 2 years to nest. So, you know, because there's a year of the nest and then the young hangs out for a year. So I didn't get to see an adult, unfortunately. But there's this, so where the Pantanal, like just north of the Pantanal, where it's like the Cerrado, that's savanna, meets like the very first Amazonian forest. There's this guest house and there's a field. And like on the edge of the rainforest, and like literally like the first rainforest giant in the forest, which is barely even in the forest, is like cleared around the bottom, has a harpy eagle nest.
Wow.
And so, and it's funny, we went there and the young wasn't in the nest, and so we're like, oh man, maybe our timing was off. And then someone was like, we're like, well, what should we do? Should we go on a hike? Should we stake out? And then someone's like, why don't you just turn around? And it was like 100 yards away in a tree. So we got to see that. And then we did do our hike and saw a bunch of, you know, great birds. And then came back and the young was in the tree. It was eating a Siriyama. So in the time that we had left, an adult brought in a prey item to feed it. And so we could have seen, you know, an adult come in with prey.
A big prey item,
and,
right?
Yeah, and what's cool is, you know, Siriyama is like these, they're like the secretary bird, a bit smaller, but they're still a good-sized bird. Secretary bird of South America, there's two species, and they like open country. So a harpy eagle, you usually think of like, again, it's kind of like a flying jaguar. It's this thing that lives in dense forest, and you don't get to see it hardly ever. And they don't soar above the canopy, so it's like very difficult bird to see. And but this bird was obviously out in the open hunting Siriyama, and I heard that you could see them sometimes taking goats out in the pastures there. So that's, I thought that was really cool. I think they're actually a bit, they'll nest in like a gallery forest in like the Cerrado, so I think they do. It's just I don't think there's that much of like a tourist infrastructure out there, so I think, you know, they are mostly in rainforest, but I think they are a bit in more habitats than we think of harpy eagles.
Right.
But probably people just not really the tourist infrastructure, you know.
Right.
To where they are.
Yeah, that's so. That's definitely a nemesis of mine. And I just spent so much time in its range, and I just always thought I'm just going to see one kind of sitting up on that ridge line, or you know, I'm just going to luck into it. Nope, it hasn't happened yet. So I'm curious, how big did it really seem to you when you saw it? Was it like overwhelmingly impressively big, or not as big as you thought it would be, or?
You know, I think my impression of any eagle has been soured. I don't know if soured, but like in terms of being wowed by its size after seeing Stellar Sea Eagles.
Right.
You know, like there's nothing that looks as imposing and ridiculous as a Stellar Sea Eagle. And they are by a couple measurements. I think consistently they have the longest wingspan. Although I think there might be like one record of a white-tailed eagle with a longer wingspan, but I think consistently they have the longest wingspan, and they're also the heaviest. So, and they have the most ridiculously biggest bill. So I think seeing a Stellar Sea Eagle, anything after that looks, you know, it looked big. I mean, I didn't get the impression it seemed like bald eagle size to me. It didn't really feel significantly bigger, but I think perhaps seeing it in, I know the young are the same size as the adult, but for some reason I feel like seeing it like all light gray might not seem as, somehow that like darker like steel gray kind of, but that chest band, I think that of the adult, maybe that would have made it seem bigger and more imposing, you know.
Right.
It was a little goofier looking than I thought. You know, I think they're kind of goofy looking when they're young. When they're older, they get more scarier.
Dignified.
I almost feel like I need to see it again. even though it's on my list, you know, I saw it very well. I have photographs of it, you know. It was, for a while, it was like my Facebook background, you know. But I kind of still feel like it would be a feeling like a lifer to see an adult.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I find, I don't know, just your perception of size in raptors is, it just depends a lot on the conditions. Like, are you in forest? Is it soaring? What's the light like? And then, you know, males and females are often so different in size as well. You know, I was just talking about this place that has Madagascar serpent eagle, and I was just up there a couple weeks ago. And we radio tracked a female there. And after like 7 hours of effort, finally saw it. And it was just impressively huge. And so even though I'd seen that species several times, I think I'd always seen males before, and it just never impressed me with its size. It was just like, oh yeah, you know, it's kind of like a, you know, small goshawk or something. But like when I saw the female, it was just a completely different experience.
Yeah. Yeah, perhaps. I don't know. Maybe this was a male. Maybe just, you know, the fact, I mean, there's still, you can see a little bit like down, almost looking like kind of wispy feathers kind of peeking out occasionally, so that might have contributed to it seeing younger. Although, I mean, it was still, you know, a massive bird, and it was still really cool. But
yeah, yeah, I want to see that. I'd take any harpy eagle, even a mini harpy eagle.
Yeah.
I guess it was 2019. I saw my first New Guinea harpy eagle, or it's sometimes just called New Guinea eagle. And so that was one where, okay, it was an epic bird, has a great call, but it's actually way smaller than I anticipated. Because it has harpy in the name. So you're just thinking, you know, pterodactyl. Like,
yeah.
It's really not all that big. But it's a great bird. It's so hard to see. And it's a real wilderness bird.
Yeah, I feel like the harpy eagle is almost like the opposite of what was like the first time I saw a hornbill, when I saw a great hornbill. And you're like, oh my God.
Whoa.
You're like, yeah, you're like, that's the size of a turkey. Like, because you kind of think, because they superficially look like toucans, and toucans are like, you know, they're like woodpecker to like crow size at the biggest.
Yep.
And to see something that's the size of a turkey with that bill on it, you're like, they almost, I love toucans. I'll look at toucans all day, don't get me wrong. But I feel like this, like, Stellar Sea Eagle almost kind of ruined other big eagles. Hornbills kind of ruined toucans.
Yep, I agree. You know? I agree. Well, I think a lot of people have seen maybe smaller hornbills in Africa, like African savanna hornbills or whatever, and they just don't realize that these big forest Asian hornbills are like twice the length and, you know, several times the weight.
Yeah.
Another group like that. So it's funny to guide people, and like you get to compare their expectations with what they actually see. And people are always shocked by how big the ground rollers are in Madagascar. They're these really, really cool, like intricately patterned, kind of chunky, pitta-like birds in the Malagasy forest. But I think people see them and they kind of imagine, oh, it's sort of, you know, ant thrush size. And they're like, they're big, that big, chunky. I guess they're all sort of like giant ant pitta size or bigger. So people are always just like, whoa, I had no idea it was such a big bird. It's always fun.
Nice.
So last on my list, this one's kind of related to your jaguar in the Pantanal. Actually, a very similar situation, and also a big kitty. So snow leopard is something.
Ooh.
Like, I just remember watching a National Geographic special of some kind when I was a kid about snow leopard, and they got this like horrible footage of a snow leopard in the snow, in the mountains, like up in some kind of rocky landscape. And I just thought that is the ultimate thing in the world to see. Like, I didn't even think it would ever be possible to see it. I just, you know, I thought, okay, the only people who are going to see that animal are like local people who live up in these valleys and try to protect their yaks from them. And then maybe National Geographic photographers who go spend 6 months. And that was pretty much the case until about 12, 13 years ago. And I don't know exactly how it happened, but in northern India, up in Ladakh, there was this local people realized that there was leopards around and somehow connected with local guides who, and you know, they kind of connected the tourist industry with the fact that there were these snow leopards there and that they could pretty consistently be found. And then some local guides just developed unbelievable skills in finding these things, just persistence and pattern recognition. And so just when this was happening, I went with two of my good friends, Keith Barnes and Scott Watson. That we called, this was Keith's midlife crisis, was to go try to see snow leopard. He heard about this. He heard that they were suddenly like seeable, and it was like, I have to go. And my reaction was exactly the same. It was like, I have to see this animal. Like, this is a lifelong dream. And we went and we saw them pretty easily. We did have exceptionally good luck. We saw a mother with cubs. We saw a couple of fresh kills. So we had like incredibly good luck. When we went there, it was far from sure. There'd just been a camera crew there for like 3 months and they hadn't even seen it. So we did get lucky. But subsequently, the local guides there have just been able to find them for pretty much everybody. There's even lodges now where you can stay and like have heat and comfort, and then they basically radio you when they find it, and you go out with your scope and look at it, and then you go back to the heated lodge. It's like,
oh wow,
a pretty amazing change in the accessibility of one of the world's coolest animals. And again, I give credit to these local guides. I mean, I was just blown away by just their persistence, like in scanning for this thing. You know, so we'd already seen this animal like 4 times, and we'd seen kills, and like Keith and Scott and I, we were just kind of wandering around and like looking at birds, and we were tracking wolves. Like, we weren't even thinking about snow leopards anymore. I was just out for a walk one afternoon, and I walked up to our sort of little group of local guides, and they were just sitting there with scopes, just scanning the ridges for snow leopards. Like, no one's pressuring them to find this animal. They've delivered like unbelievably great sightings. And it's still just out there, just scanning, because that's just what they do.
I gotta go do that.
Oh man, couldn't recommend it more strongly. Because
now that I got lion, leopard, and jaguar, I'm like, you know, I just need two more of panthera.
Ooh,
you know,
that's a good goal. It's just such a great experience to be up in the Himalayas in winter as well. It's just like next level mountains. Just mind blowing.
Wow. That like I don't know if reminds me of, I think this is a honorable mention, but I feel like this was supposed to be my turn, but if this is my turn, then I had mentioned 6, so I don't know what just happened. We went on to an anecdote, and I thought you went, and so somehow I went twice. But seeing that situation reminds me very much of what I'm about to mention, which also where you have these spotters and they find something, but it also ties into, you know, I say that I want to see all the panthera. I have a goal of seeing all the bears. I don't know if that'll ever happen, but so my honorable mention is the spectacled bear at Macapucana in Ecuador. We did a whole episode with this Isabel from the lodge, but similar situation where they have spotters. There's a couple of vantage points where you might see the bears where the forest kind of is like an overlook, and they just have spotters go out and they'll call down. And you'll go up and see them, which almost got frustrating because, yeah, after having seen the bears, I kind of wanted to do some birding, but I was there with people who weren't birders. So they're like, oh, let's go see the bears again. And I'm like, oh, can't we kind of like try to key out some of these like, you know, tyrants and like,
let's go for some
like,
topaculos.
Yeah. But it was awesome. The situation is there's these fruiting. But the problem is it's hard to know when you can go, right? So at this the time scale that you book your flights, you don't know whether the avocados are going to be ripe. There's a general season; it's our fall, right? But they might fruit any time from September to November. So if the avocados aren't there, they're not going to be there. So
that's tricky.
Yeah. But the cool thing is, the bears like wild avocados in the day, and oil birds like the wild avocados at night. So you go on a night hike, and it's just all you can hear is oil birds, and you put your flashlight up, and you just see oil birds flying around.
Wow.
So pretty cool,
Yeah. So that's on the west
which I
slope
think is a
of the Andes in Ecuador?
the Mindo Valley.
Mindo Valley, yeah. Yeah,
Yeah,
the place is
it's like
crazy.
the secondary growth, which I guess has maybe the restoration efforts. I'm not exactly sure, but there's a it favored the conditions regardless of human hands or just the secession as it goes favored a big population of these of wild avocado trees. So that was really cool. And just see the bears by day and the oil birds by night.
Well, you've gripped me off, Tony. And I've added a couple more places to my list. So, list
Well,
always
likewise.
gets longer.
Yeah, man, I had no idea that there was that snow leopard. There's like this is why exactly why I suggested this list, man. Snow, I mean, I don't know. Is there anything dropped? Top snow leopard? I don't know.
I think I would put it as my top lifetime wildlife sighting. It was just wow, incredible. Charlie, I think that was my number one mammal in our mammal episode, so you can hear all about it if you listen to that episode. But there's actually other places you can see snow leopard now too, and I think it might be one of these things where the culture and the skills that developed in Ladakh have been sort of shared. So I think there's a place in China where you can see it in summer, and I think people are out seeing it in Mongolia now as well. So yeah, there's a
Man,
few options.
I wonder if there's a. Do you know any opportunity to see panda, wild giant panda in the wild?
I think it's virtually impossible now, and I think there's some issue with the Chinese government now. It makes it just virtually impossible unless you're a researcher or something. The latest I've heard, that would be an amazing thing to see. I was talking to Keith
Yeah,
about
'cause
trying to see panda.
I got three bears left, and they're the hardest, I think. Asiatic black bear, which I think there's some places to see it. That's the easiest of the three left, and then sun bear and the panda. So,
Yeah, bears are
yeah,
amazing.
that.
What's the favorite of the ones you've seen so far?
I mean, it's the obvious, but polar bear. There's
Yeah.
nothing like the seeing animal that's like the boss, they just walking around, they got no cares in the world, and they're obviously intelligent, but you can just see them working out stuff, walking around like they own the place, there's nothing like it. They're both like adorable and menacing at the same time,
I mean, it's probably the animal on Earth that has the least fear of humans, right? At least a terrestrial, somewhat terrestrial animal. I really
I would
wonder,
think in the
like, if grizzly bears used to be almost like that, and then the ones that had like zero fear of humans got just wiped out of the gene pool, and then the ones that are left now are like on the extreme timid end of the spectrum for grizzlies.
Yeah, I would think, because I heard like reports like Lewis and Clark and whatnot were saying that they were just pretty, bold, and they would, and they're like an open country species, so they were out in the prairies much more than people realize, so they're probably like polar bears, but just out and about, pretty obvious, on their landscape, but then
And I guess they could outrun you if you're a human. And can you imagine being chased by a grizzly in open country? That would be something.
Well, I remember. So we do this thing where every time we left, we have to get up on the roof. Before we left, we get on the roof of the one of the buildings and scan for polar bears. And I got up and I one time and I just I might not even. It's not you just go up there because you're bored and you're scanning around. I saw a bear and I watched it and I saw for like I don't know how long I watched it for, but I realized that I had walked the same stretch that this bear had, and it would have taken me like an hour, like 10 minutes,
Oh man,
just his gait,
just effortless. Yeah,
Yeah. They so just have this.
I actually did a couple of weeks of backpacking up there on the Hudson Bay, but I did it early before the bears were around. And but despite this, you know, I had to walk around with poppers and a Winchester rifle and like all sorts of bear countermeasures. And so never actually saw one. So I still haven't seen a polar bear, but I've like lived in their near proximity, and it's amazing how big they like figure in your mind when you're just thinking about this, the possibility that a 9-foot bear could just pop up anywhere.
Well, yeah, you have to do all this training and everything, and you know, we carry shotguns with us. And then what you think is cool until you have to carry a shotgun with you all day, and then you're like, this kind of sucks.
Yep. It's not all that cool.
And one day we decided to fool around and all of us were like take turns shooting. And so obviously the best shot was the guy who was his day job was a goose guide, right? So obviously he was the best shot. And the next best shot was me. And everybody else was terrible. Like, so I was like, all right, I'm not letting it. I'm like the two best shots in camp need to have a gun, you know, like at all times. I'm not letting anybody carry, you know, I'm not handling, you know, like I'm not putting my safety in anybody else's hands, you right. know, like, so.
Although apparently what you want to do oftentimes is like spray gravel in their face and just like shoot in front of them. And then they just get kind of annoyed and yeah, it would be, but just even having that degree of precision under those unbelievable, like adrenaline pumping conditions would be something.
Yeah. Well, they told us that, like obviously if it's charging you, shoot it, you know, like, but they said with the thing about polar bears is they're hunting you, and a grizzly is often like a defensive, like you, it's
right.
eating blueberries or has a bison kill or something, and you surprised it, and it's, I want you out, I have a resource, you're a threat, and a black bear is also, usually it's a predatory attack, they say, and but since a black bear is, you know, they're big. Don't get me wrong, but you have at least some chance of maybe fighting it off, or like being like, this ain't worth it. Because you know, animals don't want to get injured, even though they can clearly take you. They don't want to. If there's a chance they'll get scratched, they could get an infection and die. So if they think you're too much trouble, they'll leave you alone. So you fight back against a black bear. You play dead with the grizzly, but the polar bear, it is hunting you. But it's stalking you. And since you have this, like, big viewscape. Oh. Interesting. We've lost Ken. I will try to call him back. Here we go. You there? You okay.
Yeah, sorry about that.
All good. So I got you back. Yeah, so saying that the polar bear, because they're actually, you have these big sight lines and they're actually actively stalking you, if you can make it aware that it, like somehow, like that you can see it, right? Like, it might break off its stalk, you know? Because, like, there's a good chance that you'll run away and a 1,000 plus pound bear doesn't want to run after you.
Right.
It'll actually waste too many calories. So, and they say, and they're very curious. So say like, maybe like take off your backpack, especially if you have your lunch in it, and it might stop and sniff that and just give you distance, you know? And eventually it'll be like, cause they're, you know, so that's the thing. They like to ambush you. And if they're, you know, if they see that, you know, they're there, they'll tend to leave you alone. But you know, you go through these trainings, like gun training, were you supposed to have a hunter safety card before you go? The funny one was mine was from 1987. but they have you practice with the cracker shells, they have you practice with the slugs, and then like you have to read all these documents before you even go up there. And it's such a part of your life that, like, you know, I kind of had like dreams about polar bears for for months afterwards. And sometimes every once in a while I'll still have a dream about a polar bear. And which, you know, speaks to what you're saying about, like, they're constantly a presence, and which I've said this a couple times. I by no means am I trying to equate my experience up there to the experience of a soldier, but the fact that, like, I couldn't talk to another person for, like, a couple days when I got back to town, and the fact that I've been dreaming about polar bears for, like, months, like, every night, almost every night, gave me a kind of idea of, like, what must being in, like, a war zone.
Yeah, the psychological impact of, like, the way it works into your subconscious, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Like, just...
And a bear, like, has no ill will to you, you know? It's just, like, you're just a piece of food, whereas, like, actually... Like, having other humans who want to kill you is must be a pretty intense thing to have to deal with.
Yeah, but polar bear is my favorite bear. I mean, my favorite sighting, but I think my favorite bear, though, is black bear. It's the perfect bear.
Ah, I love black bears. Yeah.
They're like, you know, they're like right in the middle of the size. I mean, they're actually on the higher side. People are like, oh, they're small. I'm like, they're not. A 600-pound bear isn't small, you know? Like, they're not small. Like, you know, they could, you know, even a 400, 300, a 250-pound bear isn't small, you know? And it's way stronger than you. But they're, like, they're perfect looking. I think they're just cool looking. The grizzlies kind of have a weird face. Polar bears are almost like their own thing, you know? But they still have the kind of, their head's kind of small in comparison to their neck. They got that, like... A black bear is the perfect looking bear, in my opinion.
Bears are amazing.
I don't know if, I live in Philadelphia, and I had a black bear on my street.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
It just seems like they're getting more and more common in the Northeast.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's 20,000 of them in Pennsylvania.
Really?
And I live in the, I live in the third house in from a 1,900 acre, park, one of the largest municipal parks in the world, and it's all forest pretty much. And but I think it's just a bear from the mountains, you know. Young bear came out of hibernation its second year. His mom's like, you gotta go. Its father, or it was probably like, you gotta go. It kept getting kicked out of territories and just, you know, somehow ended up in Philly.
Amazing.
And this is the third one we had in, like, you know, 4 or 5 years in Philadelphia. So my heart out isn't as hard anymore, but the baby's asleep.
Nice.
But yeah, we're just about at an hour. I don't know if you have any honorable mentions, or is there anything else you want to pop in your head about easy places to see hard animals?
Oh man, there's so many. At first I struggled to think of them, and then I started thinking of them, and it was like, there's so many. So it could easily do a whole nother discussion about this, but hey, it was a great idea. It was a good concept. Brought out some good stories about some cool places.
And if you want to do something, yeah, hell yeah. If you want to do something with the three of us, you know, I'll propose this on air, but we could obviously deviate from this because I'm a fan of your podcast, so I'm a fan of Charlie as well.
Charlie. Let's do it. Absolutely. Let's do a Naturally
another
Adventurous.
Another idea would be, yeah.
Or we could do a swap, like you said, where we put it on both feeds.
We'll
cool, do something for sure.
Well, an easy one would be best cities to see wildlife in. You know?
Yeah,
because, like, I know you go out, but, like, you know, the OG podcast for us is the Urban Wildlife Podcast. So it'll, like, top, you know, everybody gives their top five best cities to see, and we'll probably have to do a couple of honorable mentions because I bet you there will be some overlaps. But that's a, you know,
yeah, it's a good idea. And I would love to do something about music, if you're up for it as well. Just because I always find it interesting to talk to anybody who's passionate about anything, and the fact that you are passionate and knowledgeable about, like, these two very different domains, I think that could make a really interesting discussion as well.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And that, you know, I did so much of my, you know, I've been into birding since I was 9. And as you, unfortunately, it happens with, as you get into your late teens and early 20s, you're often kind of like focused on, like, where you're going to meet new friends and romantic interests.
Yep.
rather than, like, your hobbies. So it kind of took a back seat. But then when I started touring with bands and my own band, just the fact that I was in a new place made me start thinking about, oh, what birds could I see here? And so music, you know, got me away from birding, and then it brought me back into it. And then to the point where, like, we literally, I missed a show in Malaysia for birding. Not intentionally. I didn't realize that it would take 11 hours or 12 hours, 11 or 12 hours to go 100 miles by bus. And we budgeted ourselves 10 hours. Nice. So, but when that happened, I was like, it was kind of worth it.
Yep.
You know, like, and I was like, okay, this just shows where my priorities are. It's time to maybe look at something else in life. You know, I should probably do what I'm really concentrating on. You know, the fact that, like, I'm playing in my band in Asia, and I'm really want to just, you know, look at hornbills and, yeah.
When passions, like, collide.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, this is awesome that we got to play a show in Borneo, but I didn't see a bristlehead, you know? It's just like...
Failure.
Yeah. But yeah, yeah, absolutely. That would be great. And it's an honor because I'm such a fan of... I can't say enough. I'm such a fan of your podcast. And it's kind of like... It's almost like if someone... If I was like, this is... an idea for a great podcast. I wish someone who had this experience could do it, and you guys just did it. So
it's like, cool.
Like, it's exactly the what I like. I like conversational podcasts, and I like you know the topic, and I love the list. So I'm a sucker for it. So yeah, I hope everybody, if you're a fan of our podcast, you'd definitely be a fan of theirs. So it's Naturally Adventurous. Look at it on your podcast app of choice. Obviously, like and subscribe this podcast, and I look forward to talking to you in the near future. Give Charlie my best. Tell him I'm a big fan. And anything else before we go?
Thanks.
Want to make sure we got across.
Thanks so much for having me on, Tony. Good to connect. It was a fun chat, and we'll definitely do it again on some platform. Hopefully,
and as much as I love the content, as much as I love your content, I hope you get back to work soon too.
Oh man. Well, it'll be interesting to see how the podcasting goes once tourism is back online. But
yeah,
cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yeah, but make it a priority because it's a winner.
Yeah, thanks
a lot. Cheers.
Thanks. All right, take care, Tone.
Okay. Have a good one. Bye bye.
Cool.